Hi everybody, good evening. I just wanted to say how delighted we are to be hosting this as our inaugural lecture for the new York Centre for the Americas. This is an attempt to bring together a lot of work that's already being done by scholars here, focusing on the way in which the Americas can be understood through different nations and also how it connects to the rest of the world. And so we're excited about how we can develop new ways of looking at the Americas and its links to Europe and Africa and other places, both in terms of how we teach and how we engage more publicly as well. Our website address is over here, so please do come and have a look at that and find out more about what we're doing. And there's contact details if you want to get in touch there as well. That's all I'm going to say. I'm going to hand it over. I'm delighted to say that we don't have one. We actually have two big beasts of the Atlantic slavery world here today. Jim is our very own big beast, emeritus professor here at York. I was going to say that he has published and edited over 30 books on the history of Atlantic slavery and slavery in the Caribbean. Turns out it's actually over 40 books. He's got a few more years, I think, to get over into the half century. He's also a published author on the history of football as well. But I think we'll probably leave that for today. So I'll just hand you over to Jim and say thanks to both of you for coming.
Alec, thank you very much indeed. Mine's the easiest job of all, and that is to introduce the speaker. And to inaugurate the centre, you could not have chosen a better man. Philip Morgan is the preeminent historian of slavery in colonial America. The students who've met him already and who've been engaged with his work will realize that here's a man who not only produced a string of quite extraordinary definitive essays, that engagement with archival materials throughout the Americas, a man who has written a quite extraordinary book, Slave Counterpoint, that won every prize after 1999, apart from the Oscar. He won everything in sight. And quite deservedly. It's a huge book, and it's a book that is written with flair, with imagination, and extraordinary archival grounding. And that's, in a way, in Phil Morgan's great strength as a historian. He's a man who speaks from a knowledge and understanding and mastery of archival material, but he does that with the ability that a lot of historians coming out of a similar stable don't have, and that is he's able to actually present this material in a way that's accessible, that's readable, that's that readers can engage with. And in that book and in with other collections of essays, he writes about specific things, he writes about general things. He has all the kind of qualities that you would want in a kind of working academic historian. But more than that, of course, he's also seen through and is continuing to see through some of the most outstanding young scholars in his doctoral program at Johns Hopkins on the Atlantic world. He's a man that kind of covers all bases of academic history. This year he's Harmsworth Professor at Oxford, so they've nabbed him for this evening, and here he is, Philip Morgan. Thank you.
Jim didn't mention the thing we share most in common, which is our devotion to Manchester United Football Club. And the greatest thing that happened to me this year, which he didn't also mention, is that I got a personal letter from Sir Alex Ferguson to rival the one that James got, which I'm going to have framed and put on my office wall like he has on his office wall. Anyway, my talk is inspired by a simple conceit, two individuals with the same name. The first was a Scottish doctor who in a mid-18th century travel journal wrote the best extant portrait of colonial American manners. But no one, to my knowledge, has ever noticed that, although he never visited the Caribbean, this physician heard much about the region and met many of its residents on his peregrinations up and down the eastern seaboard from Maryland to Maine. And my other protagonist was born in the Caribbean, also with a Scottish background. He came to North America a generation after the traveling doctor and lived through the American Revolution in the early national years. And he became famous, so famous that his face now adorns the $10 bill. He's even the subject of a recent hip-hop song cycle. His life story has been likened to that of Tupac, both marked by boastfulness, torrid sexual exploits, and gun duels. Be that as it may, his links to the Caribbean were deep and wide-ranging. And so my broader aim, in line with what this centre is aims to do, is to explore connections between, in my case, North America and the Antilles, and to explore some of the changes that occurred over the 18th century, because I'm moving from one figure in the middle of the 18th century to one at the end of the 18th century. So I'm interested in the larger context of what these two individual lives illumine. The subjects I'm going to probe after I introduce the two main characters are as simple as 1, 2, 3. First, health and disease. Second, local and national identity. And then finally, slavery and anti-slavery. These are not the only links that could be explored, but my broader goal is to illustrate the importance of the Caribbean to North America in this period. So in that sense, I see my work as part of current efforts to view North America in larger contexts, in this case, as part of a greater Caribbean, you might say. So let's begin with the first individual. In 1744, Dr. Alexander Hamilton, who was then a 32-year-old physician from Annapolis, the capital of Maryland, traveled northward to escape the Maryland summer, enjoy a change of air and climate, and restore his health. And there you can see his peregrinations from Annapolis northward. At breakfast in his lodgings in New York City one June morning, he met three gentlemen, two from Jamaica and one from Curacao. Of the pair, he observed, they had just such cloudy countenances as are commonly wore after a debauch in drinking. So as a doctor, Hamilton read location as well as behavior in a person's appearance. Jamaica, after all, was renowned for its libertine ways and its harsh environment, so he's reading their faces that way. The Curacaoan interjects that in a month's time he'd known either 30 or 40 souls buried, which in his opinion was a great number in the small neighborhood where he lived. So he's having this conversation, the doctor is, the chief subject of which centers on variations of climate, morbidity, and mortality between North America and the Caribbean. Hamilton's Jamaican and Curacao informants were far from his only entrees into the world of the Caribbean on his mainland travels. He encountered more Barbadians than any other islanders. When he set out on his journey from Annapolis on May 30th, 1744, he'd looked forward to traveling with a man called Samuel Hazel, a gentleman of Barbados. So just a little geography lesson there. You can see the distance from Annapolis to Barbados, about 2,000 miles as crow flies, about a three-week sailing trip in this period. So he's looking forward to traveling with Hazel. Hazel had been born on Barbados in 1691. He'd come to North America in his early 20s, and he had established himself as a merchant in Philadelphia. He'd served three times as the mayor of that city. In the Quaker City, Hazel reported that he had good news of his friends in Barbados from one he imagined called himself Captain Scrotum. A strange name indeed, noted Hamilton. But Hazel apparently always had some comical turn in his discourse. Hamilton then encountered another Philadelphia resident, Thomas Venables, also described as a Barbadian gentleman, who, when the Freemasons were mentioned, railed against that society as an impudent, assuming, and vain cabal. So Barbadians seem to enjoy both strong opinions and amusing conversation. Later, the talk turned upon the people in Barbados, especially their private characters and persons. In New York, on his return trip, he received a letter carried by a medical doctor from Barbados. He met Hazel again, who was about to depart for the island. Thus, I think you could say that Hamilton became aware of dense mainland Barbadian links and a sense of corporate identity among those particular islanders. The two Jamaicans Hamilton met in New York mentioned a free black of their island, a man of estate, good sense, and education. Again, showing the link between New York and Jamaica at this point. It's about 1,600 miles, about two to three-week sailing trip. No doubt, I think Hamilton associated the islands with slavery and with wealth. He'd expressed regret that he had not gone there, describing Maryland as far from being such a golden country as are the West Indies. Hamilton was unlikely to have met a wealthy free black in mid-18th century North America, where almost all blacks were enslaved, as in Hamilton's own waiting man, the person who went along with him on his trip, who accompanied him on his travels, a man called Dromo. So perhaps the doctor was enlightened by news of an accomplished and educated Jamaican free black. Perhaps it expanded his racial boundaries. But Hamilton's Curaçao companion revealed his prejudices at the unexpected news of a socially prominent black person when he gravely asked if that Negro's parents were not whites, for he was sure that nothing good could come of the whole generation of blacks. Hamilton simply reported this statement without expressing any agreement, but the opinion may have reflected a sort of Caribbean sensibility he found alien. This unnamed free black was almost certainly this man, Francis Williams. He was educated in England, gained recognition as a mathematician, authored poems in Latin, is portrayed, as you can see here, in his library in Spanish Town, the island's capital, where he ran a school and died possessed of 15 slaves. He must have been the very agreeable companion, though of an African breed, a Creole of Jamaica, of Negro parents, who befriended a Scots doctor on that island in 1744, the very year of Dr. Hamilton's grand tour. The Scottish physician on Jamaica recalled the black man as a person of, Francis Williams, as a person of superior genius, with a more liberal education and a better understanding to improve it than any of the Creoles that ever I have had the honour of knowing in Jamaica. So the fact that a Jamaican free black's renown could reach New York in 1744, be the subject of a discussion about the alleged inferiority of people of African descent, I think is quite notable. These sets of encounters hardly exhausted Hamilton's Caribbean associations as he travelled in North America. In Joppa, Maryland, he drank a bowl of sangria, the drink that's so popular in the West Indies. His Caribbean connections were most numerous in Philadelphia and New York. He attended a meeting of the Governor's Club in Philadelphia, where much of the conversation was on the expedition to Cartagena 3 years earlier, where there had been a staggering death toll of the expeditionary force. He also noted that Governor George Thomas managed the Quaker Assembly better than any of his predecessors. Thomas was an Antiguan. When in New York, apart from the two Jamaicans and the Curaçao, he met a gentleman in a green coat with a scarified face from Antigua. The man came recommended by Governor Gooch of Virginia to Commodore Peter Warren, who at the time commanded an Antigua-based squadron and regularly moved back and forth between the mainland and the island. So Warren married a New Yorker, bought real estate in New York, but moved back and forth between mainland and islands considerably. Also, while in New York, Hamilton heard that the colony had been exchanged with the Dutch for Suriname, a Caribbean colony on the South American mainland. That is one of the longest hauls from North America to the Caribbean region. Here we're talking about a distance of about 2,700 miles, something that may take 4 to 5 weeks. Newport, Rhode Island sea captains regularly caroused in Suriname, and we have this wonderful portrait by John Greenwood, who was a Bostonian, who went to live in Suriname in the 1750s and apparently painted at least 150 portraits of Surinamers in that place. In addition to in New York, Hamilton encountered a familiar Maryland merchant who told a hair-raising tale of almost drowning on a voyage to Curaçao, of being captured en route from Jamaica by Spaniards, probably based in Santo Domingo. So wartime drew the Caribbean and North America into close contact also. Although the Mid-Atlantic was particularly rich in Caribbean associations, New England was no poor relation. So Hamilton was in New London, Connecticut, when what appeared to be a threatening sloop turned out to be harmless, merely a commercial vessel from the West Indies. At a place appropriately named Horse Neck, Connecticut, people transported, he learned, a great many horses to the West Indies. Another Connecticut town, famous for its plantations of onions, shipped them all over the islands. In Newport, Rhode Island, He was much impressed by Captain Godfrey Malbone's imposing mansion, the largest and most magnificent in America, he said, with a large staircase of mahogany that had been imported from the Bay of Honduras. Over the course of the 18th century, tables constructed from West Indian mahogany with mirror-like reflective surfaces became increasingly fashionable. The mirror-like mahogany-based table was highly popular over the course of the 18th century. In Boston, Hamilton saw a white monkey from the Mosquito Shore that laughed and grinned like any Christian while fondling his mistress just like an old rake. In the Puritan city, Hamilton's fellow Scot, Mrs. Blackater, a jolly woman, entertained him with the history of a brother of hers who was the governor of St. Martin, a small Dutch settlement in the Caribbean. So in this city, Hamilton met the most likable companion of his trip, a Frenchman, who briefly practiced law in Jamaica. Before that, he'd lived in Saint-Domingue. So all the Antillean locations to which Dr. Hamilton was introduced on his trip, number 11, and the types of connections between mainland and islands were even more numerous. Contemporaries noted the difference, as I've suggested, in the healthiness of mainland and islands. Hamilton became aware of island identities. Barbadians had the most recognizable. He likely heard the term Creole. Most obviously, trading links between North America and the Caribbean were extensive. How people lived, how they decorated their homes, what they ate, what they drank, owed much to mainland island commerce. As much as it was disruptive, the War of Jenkins' Ear, inspired by an incident off the coast of Cuba and begun between England and Spain in 1739, created privateering as well as commercial opportunities for many people in the greater Caribbean. Slavery, too, linked all parts of the Atlantic world, but most particularly, I think, North America and the Caribbean, as slaves and free blacks passed back and forth between island and mainland. These are just some of the connections that Hamilton's travel journal illuminates. On September 5th, 1793, Alexander Hamilton, then he's a 38-year-old Secretary of the Treasury. He's the most important minister in George Washington's administration. He contracts yellow fever in Philadelphia. Coincidentally, Hamilton's boyhood friend from the Danish island of St. Croix in the Virgin Islands, a man called Dr. Edward Stevens, had just arrived in the city. Having treated yellow fever victims in the islands, Stevens proposed what came to be known as the West Indies treatment, which included doses of cinchona or Peruvian bark, wines, herbs, and cold baths. Dr. Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence, the city's leading physician, led the opposition to the so-called bark and wine murderers by offering a new experimental treatment which involved copious bloodlettings and ample use of mercury. Just 6 days after contracting the disease, Hamilton injected himself into a rapidly polarizing debate by publicizing his recovery, which he attributed to the skill and care of his good friend, who's had the advantage of much experience in the West Indies, where the fever is frequent. Indeed, at this time, the West Indies was the center of medical investigations into yellow fever. The vicious political temper of the times is perhaps best captured in Thomas Jefferson's nasty jibe that Hamilton was a hypochondriac, putting himself in danger only by his excessive alarm, was how Jefferson put it. Not only did the leading practitioners propose dueling remedies, which soon became labeled either Federalist, the Stevens method, or Republican, the Rush method, but they also offered competing theories, both which relied heavily on West Indian precedents and authorities. The explanations for the disease can be simplified to two, I think. Either local causes or importation were to blame. So Rush insisted that miasmata from local swamps or effluvia from unsanitary docks in Philadelphia bred the fever. Others blamed outside influences, such as the refugees that had just appeared from Saint-Domingue and had just recently arrived in the city. So the external influence argument pointed to the role of contagion linking the Caribbean and North America, and there was an influential Caribbean proponent of this idea, a doctor called Dr. Colin Chisholm, who witnessed the yellow fever epidemic while a surgeon in Grenada. Chisholm thought the epidemic was new to the island and claimed that it had been imported from the west coast of Africa. So he was an advocate of quarantine. Rush could point to other Caribbean medical practitioners who viewed yellow fever as a variety of the common remittent fever of the West Indies and therefore as non-contagious. Republicans argued that quarantine was an attack on liberty and free trade. Federalists, they complained, were using contagion as a pretext to exclude French immigrants for their supposed revolutionary sympathies. On this issue, Federalists largely had the better of the argument. Castigating the French played better than blaming the city. As the yellow fever debate indicates, Hamilton attracted controversy like a moth to the light. And one reason was that to many of his contemporaries, he could never shed his exotic origins. As hard as he tried to adapt to North America, he was always an outsider, a foreigner. In the heated debates over the Constitution, newspaper reports portrayed Hamilton as a mustee of mixed racial ancestry. They described his writings as Creolian, from the torrid zone. At the time of the contentious Jay Treaty in the mid-1790s, many Americans suspected what they called the Creole Secretary of advocating British interests. And in the late 1790s, when he was trying to reorganize the army, critics portrayed him as a debauched Creole, aiming to command a band of mercenary hirelings. Drawing invidious Bonaparte-like comparisons, perhaps aided by Bonaparte's marriage to Josephine, who was a Martinican Creole, John Adams derisively noted that Hamilton was born on a speck more obscure than Corsica. The speck Adams had in mind was, of course, the island of Nevis, which he knew was Hamilton's birthplace. Indeed, he disparaged Hamilton as the Scottish Creolian of Nevis, or the Creole bastard, because he also was illegitimate. Tellingly, in all of Hamilton's correspondence, that amounts to 12,500 documents, he was a mine of epistolary. He was an incredible letter writer. There's only one reference in all of those documents to the term Creole. Late in life, in 1801, when he was making an upstate New York trip, he had to choose between carrying a pie or a basket of crabs. He chose the latter and then tentatively acknowledged the applicability of the pejorative term Creole to himself, because he said this: "Perhaps as a Creole, I had some sympathy with these creatures." Land crabs were common in the islands, and presumably Hamilton had empathy for a creature that was more often denigrated than praised. About this time, he built the only house he ever owned, the Grange, named after his uncle's house on St. Croix and his ancestral home in Scotland. So as you can see, it's a federal-style building, but it's got those long piazzas on both sides, which I think hint at warmer climes. Hamilton's small island West Indian roots help explain, I think, his lack of respect for local powers and his emotional detachment from any single place. He might have been more appreciative of provincial integrities had he grown up in Jamaica or Barbados. Instead, he was raised on tiny Nevis and polyglot St. Croix, neither place is likely to inspire deep local loyalties. One was too small, the other was nominally Danish. His wartime experience, which instilled a desire for strict hierarchy and centralized command, certainly augmented his preference for concentrated federal power instead of authority dispersed among the states. But from the first, he was insensitive to local power. As early as 1778, he complained that state governments were draining off the talent that could provide wise general counsel to the nation. From the winter quarters at Valley Forge, Hamilton asked, "How can we hope for success in our European negotiations if the nations of Europe have no confidence in the wisdom and vigor of the great continental government?" 7 years before the Constitutional Convention, the 25-year-old Hamilton became the first person to propose such a gathering. In the same way that Hamilton was originally an island Creole, and became a continental nationalist, a kind of hyper-American, you might say. So he grew up with and was surrounded by slavery, and yet by the standards of the day, he became an anti-slavery radical. 1 year after he was born, his mother inherited 3 slaves from her mother. On Nevis, where he lived for the first 10 years of his life, slaves formed 90% of the population. He's truly immersed in slavery. In Christiansted on St. Croix, where he resided for the next 7 years of his life, his mother supplemented her income by hiring out her five female adult slaves. And one slave boy, Ajax, became Hamilton's personal attendant. In 1771 and 1772, the firm that he worked for, a merchant firm, and when he was doing so in 1771 and 1772, he sold recently imported African captives. So we know he was personally involved in the ghastly business of readying African enslaved Africans for sale. Slavery's ubiquity in the Caribbean could just as easily have inured rather than sensitized him to the institution. That it did not speaks volumes to his idealism and humanity. It helped that his friends and mentors, I've mentioned Edward Stevens, the doctor, Hugh Knox, a Presbyterian minister in the islands, followed later by John Lawrence, who was his closest friend during the Revolutionary War, and of course the Marquis de Lafayette, his other wartime colleague, closest colleague, all of them were all staunch opponents of slavery. During the American Revolutionary War, Hamilton was outspoken about the military potential of slaves. In 1779, the plan to seek congressional approval for 2 to 4 black battalions for the Continental Army met with his unqualified approval. I've not the least doubt that the Negroes will make very excellent soldiers with proper management, he declared. To the claim that blacks would make poor soldiers, Hamilton responded that their natural faculties are as good as ours. This view was enlightened for the day, certainly far more so than Jefferson, who regarded blacks as innately inferior. An essential part of the plan, Hamilton noted, is to give them their freedom with their muskets. This will secure their fidelity, animate their courage, and I believe will have as good an influence upon those who remain by opening a door to their emancipation. So at a time when Enlightenment thinkers such as Hume, Voltaire, and Kant speculated about black racial inferiority, Hamilton insisted on human equality. And few founders opposed slavery more consistently than did Hamilton, putting the lie to the canard that he cared only for the rich and the privileged. He lived in a state with the highest concentration of slaves north of Maryland, one of the last northern states to act against slavery, but he was in the vanguard of the anti-slavery movement. In 1785, he attended the organizational meeting of the New York Society for Promoting the Manumission of Slaves. He was a member of the 3-man committee that proposed a plan for the immediate freedom for older slaves and gradual emancipation for their younger counterparts. He was not sympathetic to the charge that the British had illegally carried off slaves at the end of the Revolutionary War. As he put it, for the British to abandon those blacks who'd been induced to quit their masters on the faith of official proclamations promising them their liberty and fall again under the yoke of their masters and into slavery is as odious and immoral a thing as can be conceived. Alexander Hamilton, the statesman, not surprisingly, had more extensive Caribbean connections than Alexander Hamilton, the doctor. The former's Caribbean birth and teenage years on St. Croix gave him a small network of friends and relatives, which was soon enlarged by his fame and prominence. By my count, once he moved to North America, Hamilton had contact with about 70 people who either lived in the Caribbean or had recently done so. So 16 were Cruisins, not surprisingly, given his connections to that island, but actually the greatest number hailed from Saint-Domingue, an indication of how much that colony dominated events in the 1790s. Jamaica and Martinique were the next most important islands, but he knew people in 20 specific Caribbean locales, ranging from Barbados to Puerto Rico, from Antigua to Tobago, from the Turks and Caicos Islands to Cayenne on the mainland. The notion that Hamilton turned his back on the Caribbean once he left the region is false. He couldn't have done so, even had he wished, because West Indians contacted him, because they thought he was one of them. And part of the reason for their identification with him was the widespread belief that hot climates altered human bodies. In New York in 1744, to go back to Dr. Alexander Hamilton, he met a man there who by his yellowish complexion he rightly took to be a West Indian. His encounter with the two Jamaicans led quickly to a conversation about the different climates in the American provinces and their impact upon human bodies. Northerners, he concluded, were of a more gigantic size because their air and living was much preferable to the poor, sickly, convulsed state of the southern provinces. The tropics were, it came to be thought, a distinct disease zone. After all, most newcomers underwent a seasoning fever, a rite of passage through which European bodies became inured to the climate. In 1793, a New England migrant to Jamaica observed of her son that a six-month fever has made a perfect Creole of him. By the 18th century, most commentators insisted on the peculiarities of warm climates and their associated diseases. Bodily putrefaction, according to James Lind, the naval surgeon, who in 1768 wrote the standard work on diseases in hot climates, could be attributed in most cases to exposure to putrid effluvia, resulting in malignant fevers. It was not just heat, but air that affected human health, people thought. So not surprisingly, the meteorology of the tropics was a subject of systematic investigation from Edmund Halley onwards. By the late 18th century, the putrefactic paradigm, as you might put it, was under assault from a growing emphasis on nervous physiology. Jefferson's jibe about Hamilton succumbing to excessive alarm, if you remember, may remember my mentioning that, was part of this new attention to the nervous system. A major factor in fever, it was now argued, was fear, traceable to an individual's nervous temperament. By the end of the 18th century, some progressive physicians in the Caribbean began to argue that endemic fevers showed no putrid symptoms and had their seat in the nervous rather than in the digestive system. In the late 18th century, a growing number of practitioners attributed disease not, say, to accumulations of bile, but to depleted energy. To the fore was the notion of nervous debility then, whether caused by oppressive atmosphere or prolonged exposure to enervating climates. And there were corresponding shifts in therapeutics over the course of the 18th century too, essentially away from bloodletting to vomits and purges and eventually to chemical and botanical preparations. Treatments differed in localities and over time. Apparently the bark of the cinchona tree, for instance, was more popular in North America and in the Caribbean, where purging with a variety of substances was more likely. By the end of the 18th century, there were some physicians on the islands who began to recommend bloodletting in fevers, and those were precisely the people to whom Rush could point. He and they reinvented and adapted an old practice to new ideas about the body. Nevertheless, many West Indian physicians came to favor restorative treatments, so they began suggesting you should bathe in warm and particularly cold water, which, as one claimed, excited the tone and vigor of the body. So once the alleviation of the causes and symptoms of nervous debility became the primary aim, rather than the evacuation of dangerous substances associated with the putrefaction of the humors, there was growing resistance to strong purgatives, such as mercury, a greater reliance on the exposure to airs and waters of different temperatures as a way to stimulate the nervous system. So for that reason, invigorating bathing and carriage rides came into vogue. Given the emphasis on the importance of climate and air, people moved back and forth between mainland and islands in search of ways to restore their health. You might call it a form of medical tourism. Examples of West Indians moving from the disease-ridden tropical zone to the more temperate parts of North America, I think, are readily understandable. So we have one account of Charleston, South Carolina, which pointed to the presence of a great number of valetudinarians from the West Indies seeking for the renovation of health, exhausted by the debilitating nature of the sun, the air, and the modes of living in the islands. but somewhat more counterintuitively, there was a considerable reverse traffic from mainland to islands, although many emphasized the fierce malevolence of the torrid zone and the extreme virulence of that region's diseases. A countervailing benign belief existed, originating in a view of the tropics as a tropical Eden, as a paradisical, perpetual spring, where the sun was the source of superabundance. So from this perspective, moving to a warm climate could effect a cure for many ailments. The most famous 18th century American medical tourist is 19-year-old George Washington, whose only foray outside of North America, a trip to Barbados in 1751, was to accompany his older half-brother Lawrence, who'd been in poor health ever since the British assault upon Cartagena a decade earlier that I mentioned as well. Lawrence had a pulmonary complaint, and the warm air of Barbados was supposed to prove restorative. While acknowledging Barbados as the finest island of the West Indies, Lawrence explained to his father-in-law that this climate has not afforded the relief I expected from it. His view was that without a change of seasons, our bodies are too much relaxed. In the late 18th century, the Caribbean was in the vanguard of medical reform. Exotic locations fostered an empirical and experimental approach, leading to new therapeutic possibilities. The most important centres were the medical establishments of the armed forces. Naval hospitals in particular played an important role. Medical practitioners in the West Indian colonies routinely challenged, received wisdom in British medical circles. They tended to argue that fevers were the product of local conditions. They were intimately connected with the climate. They developed a distinct branch of medicine, one devoted to warm or hot climates, what we would call tropical medicine nowadays. Their most decisive break with the European authorities was their shift away from bloodletting, their faith in various chemical and botanical preparations. Their increasingly pathological approach to disease, seeing fevers as distinct entities, often imported and affecting certain parts of the body. The decline of bleeding went hand in hand with an increasing use of emetics, antimonial vomits and drugs in the treatment of fevers. Benjamin Rush likely learned a mercurial treatment from West Indian practitioners, and certainly he gained support for his bloodletting from some of them, as I mentioned. By the end of the 18th century, though, cool bathing was in the ascendant. But all these ideas came to North America via the Caribbean. Another Caribbean import was the term Creole. It derives from the Spanish criollo, meaning something or someone, usually a foreign derivation, that becomes native to a new locale. It's thought that José de Acosta, the 16th century Jesuit naturalist, provides one of the first appearances of the term in English, because in a translation of his Natural and Moral History of the Indies in 1604, you get a reference to Creoles, the Spaniards born at the Indies. Thereafter, the term was often associated with Spanish Americans. Alexander Hamilton, the physician, may well have come across the term, although it wasn't widely used in North America at mid-century. Creoles lacked positive qualities, so the stereotype went. According to a Massachusetts newspaper report, they have all the bad qualities of the Spaniards from whom they are descended, without the courage, the fortitude, and the patience which form the fair side of the Spanish character. Such negative connotations account for Puritan minister Cotton Mather's famous fears of Creolean degeneracy. Since Spanish Americans born in the Indies became known as Creoles, whites of British origin in the West Indies too were often described as Creoles, and to some degree, over time, even embraced that term. William Dampier, the buccaneer, was one of the first British authors to use the term in 1703. The earliest known mention in North America occurred in a Pennsylvania newspaper in 1722. Edward Long's famous History of Jamaica offered a largely positive assessment of the physical character of Creoles, a term he readily used of native-born Jamaicans, who he saw as stamped by the climate and local environment. Thus they were in general tall and well-shaped, with keen and penetrating sight. They were surprisingly agile, graceful dancers. Their cheeks were remarkably high-boned. His adjectives tumbled forth as he gushed about their characters: sensible, brave, good-natured, affable, generous, while acknowledging their many faults. supineness, indolence, haughtiness, fits of rage, and fickleness. Most often, the characterization of British Creoles in the Caribbean was negative, and this pejorative view intensified greatly during the Stamp Act crisis. North Americans described the stamp paper that came from the Caribbean as the marks of Creole slavery. West Indians were mean-spirited, cowardly, dastardly Creoles because of their failure to resist the act. Despite having a large and rapidly growing locally born population, English settlers in North America shunned the term Creole. They wanted to be and thought of themselves as English or British, and only occasionally as American. Luxury, dependence, and slavery tainted Creoles. Interestingly, the term Creole, when applied to slaves, was more uniformly positive than when used of whites. Mention of Creole in conjunction with a slave conjured up connotations of good sense, hardiness, fidelity, compared to the supposed backwardness and alien character of an African. According to an early history of Barbados, Creolian Negroes despised saltwater Negroes and began to value themselves much on being born in the island. So North Americans might encounter many positive accounts of Creole slaves, if not necessarily of Creoles in general. The ascription Creole came to prominence at the end of the 18th century when three-quarters of North American newspapers' references to the term occurred, and the primary association then was with Saint-Domingue. And of particular interest is a South Carolina newspaper article, A Character of the Creoles of Saint Domingo, that's how most North Americans refer to Saint-Domingue, published in 1788 before the revolution occurred. It began from the premise that the burning heat of the sun in the torrid zone so affected the organs of the inhabitants as to make them very different from those of more moderate climes. A scorching sun was usually thought to debilitate, but in this case, the argument went, Creoles were generally well-made and of an elegant shape, not swaddled in infancy, their limbs rarely suffer any deformity, but receive from the temperature of the climate an activity and suppleness, lauded for their ease of movement, their majestic walk, the women's delicacy of features. Creoles had a lively imagination, a quick apprehension, occasioned by the rapid development of their physical powers. So if ambivalent at best, sometimes positive virtues as we've seen, but largely negativity were in general the North American response to the term Creole, it's no wonder that our second Alexander Hamilton avoided the term. He, like his newfound compatriots in the revolutionary era, preferred the term American. Although for a long time, English colonists were reluctant to apply even that epithet to themselves. But are there any other West Indians similar to Hamilton in shedding their small island roots and embracing a continental nationalism, engaging in what you might call a hyper-Americanism? I believe there were, but I can hardly prove the case here in the time I have available. So I'm just going to raise one example, a man called William Thornton. In many ways, Hamilton and Thornton were cut from the same cloth. They were both from the Lesser Antilles. Hamilton was from Nevis, as I've indicated. Thornton was from Tortola. Hamilton spent much time on St. Croix. Thornton visited that island at least twice and thought about buying a plantation there. They were of the same generation, both born in the 1750s. Both lost a parent in an early age. Both had Scottish connections. Hamilton's father came from Ayr. Thornton gained medical degrees at Edinburgh and Aberdeen. Both were admirers of George Washington. Hamilton served as his aide during the war and in his cabinet. Thornton offered his services to Washington as a private secretary. Hamilton and Thornton knew each other and spent time together, and they both became Federalists in the United States and thought continentally rather than locally. Each thought they were engaged in nation building, supplying the props for a new republic, one through an ambitious economic program, the other through architectural plans for the new capital. And on slavery, Thornton and Hamilton thought alike. They both detested the institution. But the shifts in attitude towards slavery from the days of Dr. Alexander Hamilton to the era of Thornton and Hamilton, two generations later, were monumental. In the 1740s, criticisms of slavery were rare. A half century later, they could not be ignored. Dr. Alexander Hamilton bought slaves as soon as he arrived in Maryland. His medical practice depended on tending planters' human chattel. the domestics who served the members of the Tuesday Club, a literary society he helped found in Annapolis, were all slaves. The handle on the very box holding the club's tobacco was the head of a black man. As a member of the colonial assembly, he helped pass legislation aimed at repressing slaves, in some cases modelled on earlier Caribbean laws. The only glimmers of humanitarian sentiment are that he once freed a slave and that he treated his waiting man, Dromo, with some consideration. Moving from a time when slavery was virtually unquestioned to an era when it came regularly under attack was to traverse a huge transformation in moral perception. And in matters of slavery and anti-slavery, there was a complicated relationship between North America and the Caribbean that helped shape these changes. And I'll just mention some of those briefly. The slave trade, for example, was one important connective thread. Almost all transatlantic slavers destined for North American ports first stopped in the Caribbean. The transatlantic voyages of Ayuba Suleiman Diallo, an enslaved Muslim who landed in Annapolis, the very place where Dr. Alexander Hamilton practiced as a physician, and then Phyllis Wheatley, who would later become famous for her poetry, and of course arrived in Boston, along with most of the other 400,000 Africans forcibly brought to North America, all of those voyages were interrupted when their vessel anchored in the Eastern Caribbean. Furthermore, about one-sixth of the slaves who arrived in North America came not in transatlantic ships, but in inter-American ones, almost entirely from the Caribbean. The most famous example is Olado Equiano, the black anti-slavery activist, who, if he was African, was transshipped from Barbados to Virginia in 1754. So the trauma of taking a horrific transatlantic voyage on a slaver was surely compounded when it was interrupted, or in some cases almost immediately followed, by an inter-American journey. Another long-standing association is that people in each region perceived the other as an appropriate dumping ground for putative troublemakers. New England shipped over 1,000 captive Native Americans to the Caribbean as enslaved laborers after King Philip's War. An Antiguan slave named Will, transported as a pardoned informer to his island slave conspiracy of 1736, ended up in New York, and he became embroiled in the slave conspiracy of that city 5 years later. He died at the stake in that city, naming and implicating others, a replay of his actions in the Caribbean. An even more astonishing coincidence is that in the same year, 1744, both Governor William Trelawney and Alexander Hamilton the Doctor, one in Jamaica and the other in New York, happened to be reading at the same time Daniel Horsmanden's account of the trial of slaves in that city that had taken place 3 years earlier. Trelawney happened to know a slave in his neighborhood called Hanover, who had been indicted but could not be found in New York because he was then in Jamaica. So Trelawney had Hanover arrested and sent him back to the city. I mean, just an example of the movements of between islands and mainlands. The savagery of slavery in the Caribbean stunned many an observer, including the impressionable boy Alexander Hamilton, and led to the most pointed critiques of the institution. And nothing in North America, I think, compares with what was produced by figures in the Caribbean. And if I were to single out two, the first would be Thomas Tryon, who lived in Barbados for 6 years in the 1660s and provided one of the most systematic early attacks on slavery, a tirade against the institution's violence. He's really the first popular writer to criticize slavery and writes from the slave's vantage point, personalizing the suffering, giving voice to the oppressed. And in the 18th century, the most comprehensive denunciation of slavery came from another with direct experience of Caribbean slavery, because he lived for nearly two decades in St. Kitts, and he struggled against the planter oligarchy of that island, which gave Reverend James Ramsay an unrivaled knowledge of slavery and an unusual command. The American Revolution was a pivotal event in the development of slavery and anti-slavery. The imperial crisis, in the words of one historian, directed unprecedented attention to the moral character of colonial institutions and imperial practices. It made the institution of slavery matter politically in ways it had never mattered before. It turned the slave system into a symbol, a source for self-examination. And practically, the most obvious result of the American Revolution was a division of a formerly powerful single slave system. In this regard, the revolution had two major effects. First, it confined slavery in the British Empire to the West Indies, colonies incapable of seeking political independence, inevitably weakening the institution in that empire and making an emancipation ultimately much easier to obtain. Conversely, in North America, the revolution freed southern slaveholders from imperial restraints, and the U.S. Constitution gave southern slaveholders privileges and powers that exceeded the wildest dreams of beleaguered West Indian whites. So a significant divergence occurred, a weakening of planter power in the empire, a strengthening of planter power in the Federal Republic. Arguably, an even greater transformative event from the perspective of slavery and anti-slavery was the Haitian Revolution. In 1791, the largest slave revolt in history occurred in the most lucrative colony on earth, the French Caribbean possession of Saint-Domingue. Over the next 13 years, the rebels withstood numerous attempts to re-enslave them. The Haitian Revolution was a turning point in the history of New World slavery. It marked the first major blow to Atlantic slave systems. And about 500 American ships traded with Saint-Domingue on the eve of its revolution. The colony was the second largest trading partner of the United States. Throughout the revolutionary era, the Haitian revolutionary era, at least 20,000 black, white, and colored Saint-Domingian refugees landed at ports from New York to New Orleans. North American slaveholders registered apocalyptic fear in the summer of 1793 with boatloads of Saint-Domingian refugees disembarking on American shores. Jefferson became daily more and more convinced that all the West India islands will remain in the hands of the people of color, and a total expulsion of the whites sooner or later will take place with spillover south of the Potomac. So Jefferson is linking the destinies of Saint-Domingue and the United States. He sees the fate of his countrymen in the predicament of slave owners in the French colony. Federalists such as Alexander Hamilton were generally more sympathetic to Haiti's black leaders than Republicans. From a combination of Francophobia, concern for northern commercial interests, and anti-slavery convictions. By the end of the century, even though trade had been much interrupted, the Adams administration, with Hamilton's full support, was actively trading with Toussaint Louverture. In 1799, Secretary of State Timothy Pickering sent Edward Stevens, Hamilton's boyhood friend, to the island as a diplomatic envoy for face-to-face negotiations with Toussaint. And he brokered a deal that opened traffic with Saint-Domingue. The impact of the Haitian Revolution on the anti-slavery movement was mixed. Many persons of African descent no doubt echoed the delight of black sailmaker James Fortin's exhilaration at Haiti's independence. He saw in the great men of Haiti the deliverers and avengers of our race. Yet much as the creation of the Haitian state was inspirational, the enormous destruction that occurred was an immense boost to plantation slavery elsewhere in the hemisphere. It created a huge economic opportunity for New World planters to take advantage of the resulting high commodity prices. Those with access to undeveloped land clamored for more African slaves. So we can certainly see greed overcoming fear in this case. Such certainly explains South Carolina's decision in 1803 to reopen its slave trade. South Carolinians anticipated a bonanza with large planter demand for slaves from the West, a direct consequence of the Louisiana Purchase, which in turn, of course, was predicated on the defeat of Napoleon's army in Saint-Domingue, and thus was a direct example of the stimulus the Haitian Revolution gave to the demand for more American slaves throughout the hemisphere. In 1803, Alexander Hamilton recognized the U.S. debt to Haiti for Louisiana, noting generously, "The courage and obstinate resistance made by its black inhabitants, to whom we are indebted for the purchase of that colony." It seems a fitting coincidence that Hamilton, who, unlike Jefferson, was willing to acknowledge the importance of black-led Haiti and recognize it, died prematurely in 1804, the same year Haiti declared its independence. So through the lives of two Alexander Hamiltons and some of the larger implications of who they were and what they represent, I've tried to show how central the Caribbean was to developments in the Atlantic world. Enormous changes in the relationship of North America and the Caribbean occurred between the lifespans of these two Alexander Hamiltons. Most obviously, an age of revolution separated the two. Political and economic arrangements were transformed as the United States and the Caribbean moved in parallel as well as diametrically opposed, but always intertwined directions. So the US and Haiti from subordination to independence, the rest of the Caribbean from considerable autonomy to greater dependency. Accompanying the political revolutions were profound changes in ways of thinking about almost everything, from the human body, as we've seen, to new forms of identity, to the institution of slavery. So a body composed of humors was especially malleable, a nervous body was more fixed. Identities assumed greater clarity and distinctiveness. Creole came to the fore, as of course did American. Indeed, some Creoles became Americans. Slavery came under attack as never before. An institution which had rarely been seen as a problem before the American Revolution became the overwhelming problem afterwards. So revolutionary shifts took place in public and private spheres, inner and outer lives, in matters of commerce and conscience. And above all, I hope I've shown that the Caribbean was no marginal, peripheral region. The Antillean region boasted the most valuable, the most dynamic, and the most volatile colonies in the 18th century New World. As Abbé Raynal, the great popularizer of the Enlightenment, noted in 1776, when reflecting on the significance of the Caribbean colonies, the labors of the people settled in those islands are the sole basis of the African trade. They extend the fisheries and the cultures of North America. They afford a good market for the manufactures of Asia and double, perhaps treble, the activity of all Europe. They must be considered as the principal cause of the rapid motion which now agitates the universe. So Raynal was correct to note how the islands extended the cultures of North America. North American Caribbean crossings were and remained vital. And we've seen their influence less in the prosaic movements of people and goods, but in matters of health, identity, and slavery, as represented in the lives of two very different Alexander Hamiltons. Thank you.
I assume you're going to have a few questions.
Absolutely.
Can I start them off? Could you perhaps make a comment about the one group of people that in some ways, they're absolutely central for everything you're talking about, but in a way they're the noises off stage for much of this, and that is, of course, the Africans. I was thinking particularly about medicine, because the men of medical interests in the Americas have a body of people that you can experiment on, that you can try things out on. And would it be worth thinking of two things? A, the degree to which the practice of medicine, experimental medicine, say, well, the inoculation or vaccination is one.
One example.
But also the question of what does the black body tell you that is actually different from the white body? And related to that, what do they learn from the Africans themselves? Because the Africans come with their own cultural medical practice.
They do. If I had longer, I would have expounded on some of these issues. But yes, I think you're absolutely right about to take the sort of treating the black body as an object, the reason for the empirical experimental nature of much of the medicine that's being practiced in this zone is indeed that they have these bodies that they can dissect and explore. And it's actually not just black bodies, I would say, but also, obviously, soldiers and sailors are another prime captive population as well, in a sense, not on the same scale. But so yes, I think this does account for why they're willing to repudiate or at least question, interrogate what medical authorities in Britain or France or the or metropolitan areas are telling them. That's part of it. But at the same time, as you also say, and you're quite right, that there's an interaction going on. So the fact that one of the shifts I mentioned, the turn to chemical and botanical preparations to alleviate fevers. Clearly, Africans know a lot about botanical properties and how they can perhaps alleviate fevers. They come from the most epidemiologically challenged place. They bring forms of malaria and bring forms of yellow fever to this place. White physicians are noticing, everybody notices, that Africans have greater resistance to some of these fevers than do whites. They have propensities for other susceptibilities, on the other hand, but they do notice they seem to survive yellow fever epidemics much better than do white populations. So they're commenting on that. But they are borrowing from them greatly, yes. I mean, the most famous example is just of a medical doctor who gains great prominence. I'm sure you know this person, but Kwasi, the African medical doctor for whom we have a picture from Suriname in the middle of the 18th century, and Linnaeus names a route for Kwasi, who discovers this route for the alleviation of certain fevers. So, yes, there's definitely cross fertilization across the racial boundary. I should have talked about it, but I just didn't have time. And I have been reading all of these medical tracts by these white guys who produced them in the 18th century, and they don't often tell you about their interactions with enslaved peoples, but sometimes they do. Did you get up to?
I think we have about 15 minutes for questions, so we've got a bit of time. Sorry. And I just have been reminded to point out by the purchaser of it that there's wine afterwards. So anyone who wants
try to keep them here
and have a drink,
a captive audience.
That's the reason to persist. So anyone got any questions?
Just really quickly, thanks for a terrific talk. I don't know if this is a stupid question. I do know it's a nerdy question. For your two Hamiltons, where do they think the tropics begin? And in particular, how do they orient themselves? I'm thinking especially about your second Hamilton, to the question that there's something about the tropics that makes slavery necessary. Because, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about Alexander Hamilton is that it's just long enough to see gradual emancipation happen everywhere, I guess, north of Maryland, right? So do they take a position on where the tropics are? Is it the Straits of Florida? Technically, it's the Straits of Florida, right? I mean, technically...
No, I don't think it is, technically. I think it's that topic of...
Right.
So,
but that goes between Florida and Cuba, doesn't it?
Well, I don't think they really know, so... But they, you know, there's the classic, you know, when you're on a boat or ship, when you cross that so-called line... You know, you usually go through some, you know, ritual to you cross the tropical zone. Do they know precisely where it is? And is it can it be kind of elastic? I think indeed it can be. So could it encompass Maryland in the summertime? It can feel kind of tropical, even if it's technically not. I mean, now we know that, you know, South Carolina is not tropical, it's subtropical. But did they have any notion? I think it was much vaguer and more blurred. But certainly, you know, we know where the center is, you know, which is in the Caribbean somewhere, and yes, it obviously encompasses Florida, at least southern Florida. But northern Florida is not really, you know, technically in the tropics, is it?
No.
So, yeah. You know, and we impose our modern geography onto it, but I think in the 18th century they don't. So that was... But I don't think anybody... Very few people really precisely tell you. That's the interesting thing, really, mm-hmm. I think. So I think it is sort of... Did you have another point?
Just about slavery.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's it. Thank you.
You mentioned that... Hamilton had a lot of links back to his Creole heritage. I think 70, you said, was the amount of
70 people who are West Indians who contact him, or he's in contact with. Yeah.
Are these West Indians who he's in contact with pro-slavery or anti-slavery? Because surely being from the West Indies and remaining there, it's quite important to their economy, the slavery. So surely his anti-slavery position might conflict with that, or are they anti-slavery people?
Most of the people are pro-slavery,
So surely they would, don't they come into conflict then with his anti-slavery views and his...
You know, I mean, you know people who disagree with you totally on some political issue, but you still remain friends with them or you want to talk to them. So, you know, that's just the nature of the world they live in. So, for example, I mentioned Dr. Edward Stevens, his close boyhood friend, who is anti-slavery advocate. Later in his life, Stevens goes back to St. Croix and he starts trading in slaves. So, you know, people's opinions can change, their loyalties can change, we're willing to countenance people who may think something totally different from us in one area, but we're willing to deal with them on other areas. So I don't find that unusual. I mean, you know, in a sense that we all do that in life, don't we? We're willing to negotiate with certain people without, you know, we just don't maybe talk about the one issue that we find difficult between us. So, but you're right. There's very few people in the Caribbean who Hamilton's in touch with, who you could really say are anti-slavery advocates. Most people who are anti-slavery advocates in the Caribbean usually leave. And it's not a popular position, is it? So it's not a place that you can countenance that very readily. So, the Quakers who are in, you know, Barbados, for example, in the early period, like Tryon, they generally flee because it's not a place that's willing to countenance an anti-slavery position very readily. So,
can I just follow up that with obviously this is an era of mostly you were talking about a kind of a hyper-national sense of identity that was kind of cultural, but this is a time where you've got people like Bolivar who are considering new forms of federation, new political systems, and then obviously as the 19th century develops, this debate over Cuba and potentially becoming a state. How do these links and affinities feed into political arguments, particularly in the independent?
You're beyond my scope. You are deep into the 19th century, and I'm afraid I just don't know anything about that.
Is it, I mean, in the case of Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, for instance, is it mostly a kind of scare tactic to accuse him of being concerned with sort of continuing the march and, you know, more interested in the Caribbean than in the colonies, or is there something there?
I can only speak to him, about something, is that, he's just seen as an exotic, as a foreign person, an outsider, in his case. He's never seen as truly an American, I think, which is, you know, I think there are others like him, actually, and there are huge numbers, but there are. And, you know, it could be, somebody like a Swiss-born Albert Gallatin, or it could be, you know, another West Indian, or, you know, in some cases, Irishman, and the Scots, you know, who can also be local. So he's denigrated on a number of levels. He's got this Scottish ancestry, he's this West Indian, he's seen as a West Indian, people describe him as a West Indian, or they use this Creole term, you know, to suggest that. I find all that very interesting, and that, you know, as much as he tried to be, never went back to the Caribbean, that's why people say he turned his back on the Caribbean, but I don't think he really did, is my view, to be honest. And then, of course, the fact that he's, illegitimate. I think there are these people who find it, who can't fully assimilate, in some cases they become these continentalists, they become these hyper-American, and that can lead them to argue for, a larger American perspective, which might mean embracing the independence movements more avidly than other people, other people who you might assume would be remark in favour of independence movements in the hemisphere. So I find it interesting that Hamilton is much more willing to acknowledge Spanish American independence than Jefferson, or is willing to acknowledge Haiti as an entity and recognise it, than our, you know, the so-called lover of freedom and democracy, an empire of liberty, but doesn't embrace those black leaders in Haiti.
We should always side with Hamilton.
I don't want to go overboard that Hamilton is this saint, which he's clearly not, but he's doing it for pragmatic, reasons as well. But nevertheless, he's not quite this, the monarchist or the only caring for the rich and the privileged that a lot of people paint him as. He's a more complicated figure. I think he's a fascinating person now. How many others are like him is an interesting question. Looking at that a little bit. But I do think they have this, I think what you're suggesting, that they have a sense of a larger American consciousness that can embrace the whole hemisphere. I think some of them have that view.
Clearly, Alexander Hamilton and George Washington have similar physical perspectives on things, in that George Washington had at least certain reservations about slavery and sympathies with this sort of Federalist perspective. And you mentioned George Washington's relationship with the Caribbean in the 1750s, and obviously Hamilton and Washington were very close during the Revolutionary War. Is there any evidence to suggest that Washington's political perspectives vis-a-vis slavery and Federalism were in any way influenced by his personal connection with the Caribbean?
All down to Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton explains everything. But on the other hand, I think that would be facetious, but I do think Washington changed his. I've argued elsewhere that Washington's opinion about blacks changes radically during the Revolution. His wartime exploits, and the fact that he's surrounded by these young aides, all of whom are really anti-slavery out. It's not just Hamilton, it's Lawrence, it's Lafayette, and others. And they're all pretty ardent anti-slavery advocates. And he sees he sees the potential for black soldiers. He sees what the British are doing, and he sees potential for American Continental Army to do the same. So he's in favour of the regiment. He doesn't think it will pass. He doesn't think it will come to pass. Of course, he doesn't. But I think he's changed by it. So, Washington goes through a greater transformation than does Hamilton, because Hamilton never really owned any slaves to speak of, whereas Washington, of course, owned a lot, and through his wife, he owned even more. So, he's a big slave owner, hundreds of slaves. So the fact that he went through, a transformation in his moral consciousness is impressive. The fact that he's really the only major founding father to free his slaves, the slaves that he owned. I think, he should be praised for that. I mean, that's impressive. He doesn't speak up about blacks as being deserving equality and respect in the way that Hamilton does. I find that interesting. Hamilton is much readier to acknowledge that blacks should have our respect, and he's not willing to think of them as inferior. I think Washington can never get over that. I think the fact that he grew up as a planter, owning slaves, gave him a pretty derogatory view of blacks, actually. So it's even some of you say, well, in fact, he freed his slaves, but only freed the man who's deaf in his will. He wasn't willing to do it any earlier than that. But granted that he did it anyway, at least he deserves that. Now, where did that come from? I think it's the war that changed his view. And the war is in part Hamilton. Hamilton's his closest aide during the war. He's talking to him all the time. Hamilton writes all of his letters. Washington hardly writes a letter during the war. It's Hamilton. Hamilton is his alter ego, really. So, you know, there's a significant influence, but it's not the only one. And Washington. Some people argue that when Washington met Phyllis Wheatley in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that changed his view of blacks. Maybe it did. You know, the fact that an African American woman could write a poem, she wrote a poem in praise of Washington. So, you know, maybe you know, that I think has an influence. But I knew a lot of things that changed his view. But I think he slightly changed slowly and reluctantly. And Hamilton was always way ahead of him. I mean, Hamilton was the young guy, you know, with all the romanticism and, you know, of youth and thinking that the world could be changed tomorrow, whereas Washington's the cold heart, cold pragmatist, who's a realist who thinks, you know, he poo-pooed the idea that the battalions of blacks could work. He thought that would never happen. You know, he proved to be correct. Whereas Hamilton was buoyed by the idea of spy. But he was a young 22-year-old.
Time to give the man a break.
I just realised that the suits are here tonight, aren't they?
We're an older generation.
Hey, you've got some sense of what I was saying at the beginning of a man who's working on top of his game. We started with two people. But we have, through this quite extraordinary rich array of materials, the opening up of the story that actually was experiment, to make sense of this complex story of time and place, this former movement of people, beginning with the Through the Eyes of Two Men, and bring us back to Two Men, is the work of a master craftsman.
Can I take you with me on my tour?
Yeah.